John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, continuing with Professor Michael McFaul, ambassador to the Russian Federation for the Barack Obama administration, and also a leader of the Freeman Spogli Institute on the Stanford campus. He is most important to me, the author of a new book, Autocrats versus Democrats, China, Russia, America, and the New Global Disorder. And he's made a promise to his fans that he'll write the next book about how Iran and North Korea and other illiberal societies are working together with the two big ones. But right now we've got a three-body problem. We have three nuclear powers, all of whom have claimed to be powerful, the great states. And it's necessary to solve them on the basis of what Michael emphasizes is leadership. The leader of the Soviet, now Russian Federation, looks to be Vladimir Putin. And we need to understand what Putinism is, even if it's not about him, if it's about the effect of him. Michael, you're right. Putinism has to be concerned. You have to be concerned about it because it's a gambler. How so? What does that mean? How do we interpret that?
Well, Putin, he was an accidental president. Let's start with that. Talk about history. He was not some major opposition leader. He actually worked within the system in the 1990s. I first met him in 1991 when he was the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. He was a nondescript bureaucrat, but he was not opposed to all those leaders. But over time, he changed as president. He became increasingly anti-Western. He became, obviously, he was anti-democratic from the beginning. But over time, he also became much more ideological, John. And I've watched it, I observed it. And then I saw it when I was in the government, where he believes that he is a defender of what he describes as orthodox Christian values, and that the West is threatening those. And I just want to be clear, that's not my view. It's his view. It's the way he frames things. And over time, to defend those values and to defend Russian civilization, and he calls it that, he thinks Russia is a civilization, he has become more of a risk taker. With more limited capabilities than Xi Jinping in China or President Trump today, much more limited capabilities, but he's used them, and at times he achieved his objectives. So he invaded Georgia in 2008, kind of got away with it. He seized Crimea in 2014 and part of Ukraine, got away with it, used his army, his Air Force in 2015 to prop up Saddam, President Assad in Syria. And that worked for a while. Thankfully, it didn't work more recently. But he used the Air Force to prop up a dictator, an ally. And then, most ambitiously and tragically, he launched this full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. That's a risk taker. That's somebody doing things that I think are risky. And by the way, are not, in my view, in Russia's national interests. I think he's damaging the well-being and security of his own people. But he's doing that because he's motivated by ideas and not just national interest.
Again, you were on the scene. Michael Zelig of Russian Affairs. You were on the scene in 2013, 2014, 2015. I believe they showed you the door in 2016. Is that correct, or was it before then?
I left in 2014.
2014. You saw, again, the Russian state hesitate and to endorse Putin's decision to go into Crimea. Was it, upon reflection now, looking back, the U.S. and its allies did not respond to the Crimean occupation, the clear violation of sovereignty of Ukraine, did not respond in the way everyone responded in 22. Is there a way to reconsider that? What was the thinking at the time, that Crimea is okay because it speaks Russian and the fleet's there, Donetsk and Luhansk are okay because they want to be Russian and they watch Russian TV? Was there that sort of rationalization, Michael?
Well, there was. So I left the government right before that invasion. So I was not in the government at the time, but it's most certainly interacting with the government and part of the debate more generally. I think we should have had a more robust response. We should have had more sanctions, and we should have provided arms to the Ukrainians so that they could deter a future intervention, a future invasion, as we saw tragically in 2022. And to that end, I applauded at the time, and I applaud today. President Trump did provide some weapons in a way that the Obama administration didn't. But I think the mistake is bigger than that. And I think you got to go back earlier, because after Putin invaded Georgia, President Bush, President George W. Bush, didn't impose any sanctions or provide any weapons. And nobody accused him of being, afraid from using military power. And I'm going to go back to 1956. And, when the Soviets invaded Hungary, we didn't do enough. Czechoslovakia, 68, cracked down on Solidarity in 81 when Ronald Reagan was president. There's a pattern here. But with respect to Putin, here's what I would say. I think it was the right bet to try to consolidate democracy and capitalism in Russia in the 1990s. I most certainly thought that at the time and participated in that, as we've already talked about. But I think in retrospect, we should have had a better hedge, that if things went badly, and they most certainly have gone really badly inside Russia, we should have had a plan B at the same time. And that plan B should have been to expand NATO faster than we did, because Russia, no Russian leader and no Soviet leader has ever attacked a NATO ally. And we should have provided more weapons to the countries in that gray zone, right? Moldova, Georgia, Ukraine. Had we provided, think about the counterfactual, had we provided 20 years ago the weapons that we provided today, I think the Ukrainians would have been able to deter an invasion of their country, because Putin would have had to calculate the costs would have been a lot higher. So that I think was the mistake we made. And in that list, I include the administration I served in, but also the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, and the first Trump administration. President Trump, he likes to say there never would have been a war if I was president. But that's just not true. There was a war the entire time he was president in Ukraine. It went on for 4 years. Lots of people died. Lots of Ukrainians died. We should have had a more robust response to that initial war, for sure.
Your book has a theme that I want to pay attention to. It's so consistent throughout it. It's, where is democracy now? Where is autocracy now? There's a moment you acknowledge that some states have taken the wrong lessons from moves like Putin's in 14, which is that autocracy is to be preferred because you get things done. Is that growing in popularity or shrinking in popularity after the Putin example around the world? We're generalizing.
Yes. Oh, no, it's growing for sure. It's growing because of Putinism. And Putinism, as I write in the book, I think we underestimated his appeal, especially in Europe and the United States. He invested a lot to promote his ideas of illiberal populist nationalism. And he's got lots of followers in Hungary, Italy, the UK, France, and here in the United States. Likewise, the Chinese model of economic development is popular, especially in the developing world, Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, Middle East. And they just say, let the state run things and we get things done. And as you know, there's a pretty big debate here in the United States about how we're just inefficient. There's too much bureaucracy. There's too many veto points. And I agree with that criticism of how we make policy. But, here in California, there's too much of that, and it stifles growth. And so this debate between autocrats and Democrats is real. My solution is not autocracy. I don't want us to be more like the Chinese to grow. My solution is more competition, more innovation. I believe that those are America's strong suits But analytically, the data is very clear that those ideas are growing in popularity, and democracy as a set of ideas is still popular, but is not as popular as it was 30 years ago.
I'm speaking to Professor Michael McFaul, the author of the new book, Autocrats versus Democrats, China, Russia, America. When we come back, dinner at Mar-a-Lago, chocolate cake and missiles. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Michael McFaul of Stanford University. He's at the Hoover Institute. He runs the Freeman Spogli Institute. And he's the author of a new book that is the beginning of what Michael promises to be several more, examining autocrats versus Democrats. And I credit his researchers. The facts are way on me. And so I want to go to a scene. I like scenes, Michael, because you enter into the opera halfway through.
Right.
It's Mar-a-Lago, first Trump term. Xi Jinping is in Florida. There are photographs in the front of the building. And later on, we're told, when they serve chocolate cake, Mr. Trump conveyed in some fashion that he just fired missiles into Syria. This is the Assad Syria undergoing civil war at the time. It didn't resolve anything, but it was missiles and chocolate cake that I remember. This is Donald Trump learning Xi Jinping and vice versa. Now, Xi Jinping is a man who resents his childhood and what was done to his father, a princeling. He was repressed by Mao and the center of the Communist Party for many years, stripped him of his authority and humiliated him. That was the Cultural Revolution. Xi himself was banished to the countryside. He tells us he lived in a cave. He lived with the peasants. A lot of reason to resent, but he turned into the aggressor. Today, he brutalizes people such as in Xinjiang, for example, the Uyghurs.
Yes.
He brutalizes the people in Hong Kong. He brutalizes everywhere. Trump knows this when he's sitting down him at Mar-a-Lago. What do you make of Donald Trump's handling of Xi Jinping? Is it appropriate to be autocratically when you're dealing with an autocrat? Does it work, Michael?
Again, really great question, tough question that I'm going to have only partial answers to. Most certainly, when dealing with Xi Jinping, we want to be strong. Ronald Reagan had a phrase, peace through strength. I think that's exactly right. And we want to show strength. That's why we tragically but necessarily have to expand our military budget. I support the president on that. And when he showed force and the ability to use force, as that story that you just told, that's a good thing for the United States, not a bad thing. We want to show our adversaries that we have these capabilities. Second, this is more controversial, but I applaud President Trump's engagement with Xi Jinping. You know, we have to deal with our adversaries. We have to communicate directly through them, with them. And even with Putin, I support that. And with Xi Jinping, they met recently. That's important as a way to manage the world between adversaries, between great powers. But third, where I disagree with the president, is I think in order to deal with autocrats like Xi Jinping, we need the Democrats to be aligned against them. And I think we're doing too much damage to our allies right now. We need our allies in Asia and our allies in Europe to be united behind us, not doubting us. And I think the president needs to work harder on that. And then finally, when he does meet with people like Xi Jinping and Putin, but especially Xi Jinping, I just wish the president, like Ronald Reagan did so masterfully, would talk a little bit more about human rights. You're not going to convince Xi Jinping to become a Democrat. That's not going to happen. But you can, when dealing with autocrats like that, when talking about those issues, inspire the small d Democrats living under tyranny, you know, in places like Tibet, Hong Kong, Xinjiang, inspire people worried about being threatened by them, like the people living on the island of Taiwan. I was just there recently, and I know that they need that inspiration. And I just think you can do both of those things. And I wish you'd just put a little more emphasis on the values part while he's engaging with people like Xi Jinping.
Staying with your theme, is there a democracy voice in China today? Does it breathe free, or is it having to hide under the covers?
There is a voice for freedom in China. I meet those people from time to time, but they're hiding under the covers. This is a time, because it's become more autocratic, the risk to your livelihood, the risk to just keeping out of jail, are much greater today than they were just 15 or 20 years ago.
I mentioned Jimmy Lai. You know the story very well.
Yes, publisher, I know his son. Yes.
Publisher of Apple Daily. I believe it's 5 years now he's been detained with charges that are basically he believed in freedom of publication. Okay, there it is. Now, that is an example of what she makes of our understanding of democracy. But at the same time, Jimmy Lai has become a symbol. Is it useful to be a symbol, to suffer the way he does, but to be a symbol for democracy in China? Are people listening?
Well, it's not useful to him. I wish he would be free. And I just met recently with his son, and I applaud the efforts to keep him in the news. I applaud your efforts, John, right now to mention Jimmy Lai. This is atrocious. It should not happen. And it should get a lot more attention. And it's an example of something that President Trump should have talked about his case when he just met with Xi Jinping. Ronald Reagan did that. George W. Bush did that. Barack Obama did it. I was in the room when he would bring up cases of repression of Russian dissidents and Russian business leaders. Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Doesn't mean you're going to achieve success right away, but you cannot forget them. But I do think it does inspire people inside China. And therefore, the more that we can bring attention to these kinds of cases of repression, I think that is good for all small-D Democrats, both inside China, but also Hong Kong, but also Taiwan, and also in other parts of the world. The autocrats that you've been hinting at, right? They're united. Russia, China, and Iran, North Korea, they have a self-help alliance system. You know, Putin invades Ukraine, and he gets drones from the Iranians, he gets soldiers from the North Koreans, he gets money from the Chinese. We small-D Democrats need to be more aligned and in more solidarity, including those small D Democrats that are imprisoned by the autocrats.
The book is Autocrats versus Democrats, China, Russia, America, and the New Global Disorder. Michael McFaul, professor at Stanford University, director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. He's also at the Hoover Institution. We're going to turn to what is to be done, both in Russia and in China, in managing with autocracies that at this point are non-transparent. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, spending time with the Professor Michael McFaul. He's the author of a new book, Autocrats versus Democrats. It comes not only from his experience as a reader, but also as someone who speaks Russian during the times of crisis in Russia. This is the late 20th century. Right now, we have a time of crisis in Russia in the early 21st century, and we don't know how it's going to come out. Michael has recommendation that Democrats in Russia are listening, and so they'll pay attention to how Michael's book is heard by the American people. And voices such as Michael speak out against what Vladimir Putin has rendered his country. Tens of thousands. We have no idea how many damaged families there are. We just don't know. We can only guess. But there is something to be done in the meantime. Russia is not integrated into the world trade system. It could have been. It was. But right now, it's being decoupled from the system, chiefly because it no longer can count on its energy being bought by the Europeans. What can be done with Russia now and looking to the future? Michael, this is the part of your book I most enjoyed because you're speculating about part of the century that I will not see. 2050 and beyond. And I'm counting on you to be there, Michael, so to answer questions about what you see. What can be done, given that Vladimir Putin is a man who looks to be in charge, and yet there is a story, I hear it repeatedly, that he is not all that powerful because he's frightened of his right wing. His right wing is understood to be not just nationalist, but supremacist, who are ready to use nuclear weapons at any moment. What can be done with an autocracy that is so sealed and yet it's so dangerous to our European allies and to world peace?
Well, most immediately, we can help Ukraine win. That would be good for Ukraine, and it'd be good for small D Democrats and liberal-minded people inside Russia. There's just no doubt in my mind about that. And I'll tell you two stories about it. I've been in the room with Vladimir Putin many times when I was in the government. And one time I heard him say that we're different than you Americans. You know, he actually looked at his skin. He was meeting with Vice President Biden. And he said, you know, your problem, you guys, you look at us. And because we look like you, you think that we think like you, but we don't. We're different than you. That's his argument back home for why he needs a strong dictatorship, strong hand to rule Russia. But he also says that Ukrainians are just Russians with accents. I've heard him say that many times. They're just part of the Russian nation, artificially divided by us, first from by the Bolsheviks, by the way, in 1917, then by the CIA, in his view, in 1991. But if Ukrainians are practicing democracy and freedom, that undermines his argument about why they need dictatorship in Russia. So I think consolidating democracy at the end of this war, even if it means some territory might be occupied by the Russians for a while, that will inspire change on the eastern side. By the way, not unlike what happened during the Cold War, where in 1989, those living under tyranny decided we'd rather be part of the prosperous West Germany instead of the autocratic East Germany. And they literally walked across that end of the Cold War. I can imagine an opportunity like that in the future. So help Ukraine win, more weapons, more sanctions, so that this war can finally end. To your other point about the fascists, though, in Russia, they have real fascists. That's true. We don't know how powerful they are because we don't have good opinion polling. But they are strong, and they've gotten stronger as a result of this war, because they now believe that the world is out to get them, and Putin's weak. That's the argument they make. He's not strong enough. He's not fighting back. And I don't know what will happen in the post-Putin era, and I don't believe anybody that predicts it. But I do think there'll be a struggle between the liberals that want to get back with integrating, and these much more nationalistic forces inside Russia.
That takes us back, doesn't it? The lessons learned of 62, of 91, of 89 in China, 91 in Moscow. They'll come again and again when we are faced with what the plan B. If Putin goes, what do we do? Do we have an answer yet, Michael?
Well, I write about it in the book. Let's not lose the peace. I think we did that in Russia. And my answer is not to have illusions that we can foment revolution inside China and Russia. I just don't think we have the means to do that now. And we should be modest in the efforts and our capabilities right now. But when there is a breakthrough led by Chinese and Russians, not led by us, we have to embrace that moment. We have to engage that moment. We have to support the new democratic governments of Russia and China to a much greater extent than we did in 1991. That was an opportunity lost. We can't lose it again.
I come to your recommendation that I was most attracted to, which is to be inviting to the talent. We know that the talent of Russia started fleeing the moment the war started in 22. They're in Yerevan, they're in Baku. I've seen them in Baku. Russian,
oh, wow.
whole rows of Russian restaurants opening in Baku. They're especially in Istanbul, especially, because they got out knowing that they weren't going to have their lives. These are well-trained young people, entrepreneurs. We can continue to attract them. Can we do more to attract them? Can we reverse this crazy, I don't know, I don't want to characterize it. There's an odd visa policy right now.
And yes.
I believe that does not open the door to the talent that could come here. Do I say that correctly, Professor?
Absolutely. And that's a great lesson from the Cold War, success from the Cold War that we have to replicate. We managed to through our immigration policy, to attract the smartest, most talented people in the world from everywhere, especially from those communist societies, right? They're some of the biggest companies where I live here in the Silicon Valley were created by some of those people. Sergey Brin, he came from the Soviet Union because we had an immigration policy to attract those people here. He's one of the founders of Google. And we need to continue that strategy again, and we're not doing it. We're not bringing in those people. We're not making it easy for asylum seekers to come. And now with this new $100,000 charge for H-1B visas that the Trump administration has put in place, I suffer from it myself. At my institute that I run, we had somebody we were bringing from the UK, and they got caught in this H-1B thing, and we don't have the money to pay $100,000 to support that visa. And that means this is incredibly talented individual that could be contributing to Stanford will not be here. And that's just a micro story of just, many, many people that we're losing. And this was our great strength back in the Cold War, that people wanted to come to America. They didn't want to go to Moscow. They didn't want to go to Beijing. And we still have that advantage over Beijing and Moscow today. But we're starting to lose it. And the Chinese Communist Party and the institutions that they control, they're throwing a lot of money at very talented scientists and professors right now to come to Beijing, come to Shanghai. That technological competition, that's going to be what it's all about in the 21st century. We have just got to have a smarter strategy or we're going to lose to the Chinese.
You also mentioned about this no limits partnership between Xi and Putin. What can be done not to separate them, but at least to make them doubt each other? Is there any way we can weaken Russia that way?
I think yes, but with modest expectations, because Xi Jinping and Putin are close personally. They're dictatorships, and they're against the West. And what brings them together is their fear of us and our ideas, not our weapons, our ideas. So that's going to be hard to mess with. That said, I do see fissures. Xi Jinping does not support Vladimir Putin at the UN General Assembly when they vote. When there are resolutions condemning the invasion of Ukraine, he abstains. I think he doesn't want to destroy the international order because China benefits it from it. And I think, therefore, we should use those windows of opportunity to pull the Chinese away from Russia. We're not going to completely separate them. That would be folly. But I think there's more that we could do, especially to reduce the technology flowing from China into Russia and the money from oil and gas sales flowing into Russia that helps Putin conduct his war in Ukraine.
We're looking to the future now. We're looking to the future over these next years. And China looks to be the one with the most handholds when we come back. Autocrats versus Democrats, China, Russia, America, and the New Global Disorder. Professor Michael McFaul is the author. I'm John Batchelor with Michael McFaul, and we're speaking of the future of what is to be done dealing with the autocrats in Moscow and Beijing. Xi Jinping in Beijing, who is in his eighth decade, and it's time to think about retirement. And Vladimir Putin in his eighth decade. I'm in my eighth decade. You think about retirement. It's natural. So if and when they retire, what needs to be done to prepare their countries for a better outcome? China looks to have the most handholds, trade and coupling with the West on all manner of production, and they need our money. They just need it. They depend upon it. They have an export-only model with a crater for a housing department. So this looks to be opening to us, is it, Michael? Your ideas are so tempting. Is it happening?
Well, I hope I do in the book try to spell out a grand strategy for decades to come. It's not just a book for the next couple of years. And when I add up the power and on autocrats versus Democrats, I still want to be on the side of the Democrats. I still think when it comes to military power, if we have our allies together, we're much stronger than the autocrats. When it comes to economic power, yes, the Chinese are growing, but you bring the free world together, 9 of the 10 largest economies in the world are democracies. We're still stronger there. We still have stronger universities by far, including my own at Stanford. We still have more valuable companies compared to the Chinese and the Russians. GDP per capita, it's not even close. You know, we're always at the top. Russia and China are in the kind of mid-50s. I don't think they'll ever catch up with us. And then when it comes to ideational power, despite all of the troubles that we've been talking about, our ideas are still better. The world still agrees with Winston Churchill that democracy is a horrible system of government, except for all the others trying. And opinion polls show that most people around the world, not all, but most people around the world would rather vote in their leaders and choose their leaders than have a communist party, a colonel, a bunch of guys with beards claiming to talk for God. I'm speaking of the Iranians there, or a thug like Putin choose who should be their leader. So I think when it comes to military, economic, ideational power, we're stronger, but we have to be more united. If we're going to compete, we have got to be in a self-help society like we were during the Cold War. That was our great advantage in the Cold War, that we united the capitalist world, we built strong allies and alliances like NATO, and then we invested in institutions to promote ideas of democracy. U.S. Agency for International Development, Radio for Europe, Voice of America, National Endowment for Democracy, those were all fantastic institutions created during the Cold War that we're not investing in now. And I think the blueprint is bring the Democrats together and then support democratic ideas. And by the way, get our own democracy here at home in order. That makes us the beacon of emulation that we once were. We get that together and I think we'll be okay.
And yet there is, you immediately suggest to me what I haven't paid attention to because it's so unhappy. Our democracy is wobbling. Is that something
Yes.
that can be corrected with one or two elections, or is this a long-term problem that's been happening, reaching back to the 20th century? We just didn't see it.
Well, analytically, we are definitely wobbling. That's a great word. And scholars and organizations that score democracy in America, that's a consensus view. My own view, and I write about it in the book, is that our elites are actually much more polarized than the American people are. You know, I'm from Montana. I have family members that voted for President Trump. But when we sit down and talk, we agree on like 95% of what unites us. I think we're a lot more purple than red and blue. My high school debate partner, by the way, John, he's a friend of mine. His name is Steve Daines, Senator Steve Daines, from the red state of Montana. Same thing with Steve. I just think there's a lot more that unites us than divides us. And I think we need some leaders that talk in those terms. So that's number one. I have a whole bunch of institutional reforms in the book. But without leaders, that won't come about. But I'm an optimist. I think I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll get out of this polarizing, fighting time. Because at the end of the day, I think more Americans would rather talk to each other than fight with each other.
There are some practical ideas, though, that we can do with besides just waiting for the worm to turn. One of them is to deal with this present problem of trade. The administration has an idea that I've not seen supported anywhere so far, including before the Supreme Court, that trade can be derived in the hands of the president from a law passed in 1977. It seems like a very thin line that they're giving us, and I'm not satisfied with it. But our adversaries see this. Do we strengthen them when we act so divided over something so obviously wrong direction, trade?
Well, first, I'm with you on the rather exotic interpretation of that law to give the power to the president. And generally, I believe in checks and balances. I think the folks that wrote the Constitution were worried about kings. And so they put a bunch of checks and balances in the Constitution. And I support that. I think that's when we're at our best. I worry about concentration of power, because I've seen it in other countries, and I've seen the damage that one party's ruling everything and one executive having all power. That's what happened to Russia, and it destroyed that country. And therefore, we should move against it. With respect to trade, we made some mistakes in opening up too fast, bringing the Chinese in. I go through that history in detail in the book. But my response is reform it. Don't blow it up. We will not succeed if we think that we can become an oasis unto ourselves by putting up all these trade barriers to especially our allies. That's just not the 21st century. And I think it's dangerous to think that we can do that. And I would encourage people to study the 1930s when we tried to do that, and it didn't work out too well.
The turn here is, does Moscow smile when they see our
army? Oh, I forgot that part. Of course. Oh, my gosh. Do they smile? They love it. When they see us fighting amongst ourselves, January 6, 2021, if you look at their press, when we're fighting amongst ourselves, we're not focused on Moscow and Beijing, and we're weaker. And it's just that is just the facts. And when we're united, that worries Moscow and Beijing and other autocratic regimes around the world.
I was told a story once, this is in the early part of this century, that the America desk at the Kremlin was being moved to a back corner, not being listened to. Is the Liberal International desk being moved to the back corner for now, and there'll be a better day ahead? Is that, can I hold on to that, Michael?
Well, I think that's right. It's definitely in the back corner somewhere, because liberal internationalism and cooperating in multilateral institutions, building allies, these are not popular ideas either in the White House or in America. I want to be clear about that. But that's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book, you know, maybe people will just read this and say I'm some dinosaur from the past. I'm willing to accept that criticism. But I want to make the case to the American people by why we're better off engaging the world than pulling back. We're better off cooperating in multilateral ways than just going it alone. And we're better off supporting ideas of freedom, liberty, and democracy, both because they're good ideas, but also it advances our national interests, than just pretending that all that matters in the world is power. And it doesn't mean we're going to go back to the old, you know, the glory days of 1991. That's not going to happen. We have to have a forward-looking agenda. But I think that agenda is there, and that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm so glad to talk about it with you, John.
Autocrats versus Democrats, China, Russia, America, and the New Global Disorder. Michael McFaul. I'm John Batchelor.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.